My first last name is Ed Hubbard. My background, I spent 35 years in the United States Air Force. 6 years and 7 months of that I spent as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. And I don't have a title. I'm Ed.
Well, thank you very much, sir. We really appreciate you taking the time to come join us today. So, guys, I know some of you emailed me your questions already, but if you have any questions while we're on this meeting, go ahead and message them in the chat. So, Colonel Hubbard, is it okay if we just jump right into questions?
Certainly.
So, one of the first questions that was emailed to me, one of the students wanted to know what inspired you to join the Air Force Reserve at such a young age?
Well, when I was a young boy, that's the only thing I ever thought about. I wanted to fly airplanes. And fortunately, about 20 miles from my home where I was when I was a child, there was a naval training base where they trained pilots. And so when I was bored, my parents would take me out and leave me sitting by the fence to watch the airplanes. And sometimes maybe 3 or 4 hours to come back and pick me up. That's all I ever wanted to do. But when I was 17, I was in between my last 2 years of high school. I was looking for work and I couldn't find a job. And I heard a guy on the radio say, join the Air Force Reserves and see the world. And I thought, what a great idea. So I went out and joined the Air Force that day.
So one of our students wanted to know, how did you manage to complete 5 college degrees in 7 years while working in the
Very
afternoon?
Simple. Well, sorry. One of the things that we learned in prison, that all things are possible if you're willing to make the effort. The first thing I always say, two things that drive your life and your possibilities. One, you have to decide what you want to do. And you have to decide that it's within your reach, that you can do it. And then you have to be willing to make whatever amount of effort it takes to accomplish that. So when I came home from prison, I was essentially 7 years behind my contemporaries in the Air Force for promotion purposes. And I didn't have anything but a high school degree. I didn't have any college at all. So it became apparent that if I was going to get promoted and compete with my contemporaries, I was going to have to get an education. So I started out taking one class, then I took two classes, then I started taking 4 classes. So I was going, taking the same number of classes full-time students would take, only I was doing it in night school and on the weekends. And once I had finished undergraduate school, it became obvious I really need to push forward. So in 1979 and 1980, in a 9-month period, I completed 3 college degrees at the same time. I was a student in the United States Air Force Air War College full-time during the day. I was taking night school full-time, graduate school at night, taking 25 hours of graduate work at night. And I was also taking a correspondence course for a thing called the Industrial College of the Armed Forces. And I completed all those in 9 months. And I completed all those with straight A average. And the only reason I was able to do it is because I believed I could do it. And I realized the importance of it, and I was willing to make whatever amount of effort it took. I was going to school essentially 10 hours a day, 6 days a week.
One of our, and that's an incredible feat. Not many people, you know, even complete one college degree, but let alone 5, is absolutely amazing. One of our students wanted to know, how did you handle being a prisoner of war for such an unbelievably long amount of time?
Well, first you have to understand you didn't have a choice. You're locked up and you're not getting out anytime soon. And so you have to learn to live with the situation that you're in. And it's not an enjoyable event, but it's a very educational event. Turns out probably going to prison is probably the most important thing I ever did in my life because it taught me how much humans can really do physically and mentally if they get serious. And I got serious. The only option other than surviving is to die, and wasn't prepared to do that. So for about the first 5 months in captivity, I was very, very crushed. I couldn't believe I was going to have to do this for an extended period of time. And one day I was sitting in my little cell. I was in solitary confinement. I was being beaten pretty routinely. And sitting there thinking about how in the world could anybody be in a worse shape than I'm in? And I thought, if I can find something in my mind that somebody has a worse deal than I do, then maybe there's some hope. And what I came up with is orphans. Millions of orphans around the world. And if I had died that day, I was 28 years old. If I had died at that time in that little cell, then I still had a better deal than orphans do, because I knew my parents. I grew up with my parents. I had all the love and help that I needed from my parents. Orphans don't have that. And I convinced myself in about a half an hour or less, I convinced myself 99% of the people in the world had it worse than I did that day, because I was an American. I was locked up temporarily, hopefully. Someday I would come out and come back and live a normal life. And as it turned out, that's what happened. But it inspired me to try harder, recognizing there was no help on the way. I was going to be there for an indefinite period of time. And it was up to me to decide how I was going to handle that. If I felt sorry for myself, I was probably going to die in prison. So I promised myself I would never do that. And I also promised myself that day, no matter what happened in that prison, no matter how bad things got, I would never allow myself to have another bad day the rest of my life. And that's coming up on 57 years ago. I don't do bad days. I refuse to go there. You can't talk me into it. You can't convince me that I have to go there. And I will not go there. Everybody that's listening right now, every one of you have exactly the same option every day. You have to make decisions about your life, how you're going to lead your life, and whether or not you're going to have bad days. And if you decide to not have any bad days, come and join me. I don't do bad days.
That's good. We'll give you a second.
I would turn that off, but I don't know how.
You're fine. Take your time.
It's gone. That's my secretary's, or my director of operations. That's her phone. She's not here to answer. I don't know how to turn the phone off.
You're fine. So one of the students, they wanted to know, can you describe when you returned home? What was that? What, like, the emotions, the feeling, what was that like when you found out you were going home?
Well, we didn't find out we were going home until about 2 hours before we left. We had been told we were going to be released on a specific date. And when that date came, we weren't released. Then we had no idea what was happening. And so for the next 4 days, we were pretty well seriously down in the dumps, simply because we didn't know what was coming next. 115 Americans had already been released and gone home 2 weeks earlier. And it was our turn, but we didn't get released. So the morning of the 4th of March of 73, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, a guard came and opened the door to their cell. And an Air Force officer walked in and he said, "Any of you want to go home today?" And of course, obviously, we all did. And 2 hours later, we were at the airport getting ready to get on an airplane to go home. So and the emotion was, I think, probably based on years and years and years of thinking we may never get to go home. When they actually told us it was time to go get on the airplane, we were very skeptical. We weren't absolutely certain that this was for real. And until we were on the airplane, they closed the door and started the engines and we took off. Nobody was convinced we're going home. Once we were airborne, then, you know, it was bedlam on the airplane, everybody yelling and shouting and very excited and everything. When we arrived in the Philippine Islands at Clark Air Base about 2.5 hours later, we were met by a crowd of approximately 10,000 people. And we never anticipated that. We had no idea what would be on the other end when we got there. So we got off the airplane in the Philippines, met by 10,000 people waving flags and big signs that said, "Welcome home," and all that sort of stuff. It was pretty emotional. And it was so emotional that we couldn't sleep. We were in Clark in the hospital for 4 days, and then we flew all the way across the Pacific Ocean to the United States. And on the flight, we hadn't been to bed for 3 or 4 days, and we couldn't go to sleep. They gave us sleeping pills. We couldn't go to sleep because the adrenaline was so high. You couldn't relax. You couldn't do anything. So it wasn't until Thursday night. I left on Sunday morning, left prison on Sunday morning. Thursday night, about midnight, I finally went to bed for the first time. So it was a very, very emotional thing. Now, to put it all in perspective, the 4th of March last year, just almost exactly a year ago, I was back in Hanoi, and I went to the prison and I walked out the front door of the same prison I walked out of 50 years before. So I was there 50 years to the day later. Wasn't near as emotional the second time around. It was more of a look back and think how much has you've accomplished, how much you've done, seen and done in the last 50 years. Pretty overwhelming. I visited 84 countries since I got out of prison around the world, and most people don't get around to that. I'm always feel like I got one more thing I need to do before I die. I have other places I need to go and things I need to see and do. That
Now
drives me.
you're also an author, and guys, definitely check out his book, Escape from the Box: The Wonder of Human Potential. And we'll have a link for that and your
Now
website.
let me tell you about the book. I print my own books, and so you might find some on Amazon. There are used books. There's somebody else's book. Somebody else that bought a book and then tried to get rid of it, or trying to sell it and make more money than they paid for it, probably. But if you want a real book, my book, I print myself. I sign and personalize author autograph all the books, and I will send you one. You buy them from me. You go to my website, edhubbardpow.com, and you'll find a link in there where you can buy them. But you can go to Amazon. You might get one for cheap, but it'll have somebody else's name in
We're going to encourage everyone to go directly buy them from you, and
it.
we'll have the website in the video. So what key message do you hope that readers take away after reading your book?
Well, I would like to think that the primary purpose of what I do is to change, improve the quality of life of all the people that I meet. And I do that by trying to change the way they see the world. Most people, when I speak, I've talked to 4 million people. Every time I speak, first question I ask of the audience, how many have had at least one bad day in the last 30 days? Literally 100% of the people raise their hand. My message is, you have no facts to support that. You raise your hand on perceptions, and perceptions actually rule the world. This doesn't matter what's happening in the world. It's what you think is happening that drives how you feel. And if you think you're having a bad day, then you probably will. But if you can get over that and look at the world the way I do, every day is a good day. And you have to understand how much more is out there for you physically and mentally. That's why I went to college. That's why I got 5 degrees, because I wanted to prove that I could do that, to not for somebody else, but I want to prove it to myself that I was able to pull that off. When I was in the Air Force, I had all these young kids working for me, and they would come in. I say, "What are you doing about school?" And they say, "Well, I don't have time for that." And I said, "No, you work for me. You have all the time in the world. Tell me what you need for time, and I will make that available to you." And they say, "Well, I just don't think I can do the job and go to school at the same time." And so I use my personal experience. I says, "I went to school 10 hours a day, 7 days, 6 days a week for a year. Don't tell me you can't do it. It's just the fact that you haven't decided you need it bad enough to go and do it." So my message is, well, I have a message from my mother's minister about 25 years ago. He sent me, gave me a little note with a quote on it. He says, "See if you can find a use for this quote." And the quote says, "The only true monument to mankind is the mark you leave on the life of another person." And that's what drives me, because I know every day I'm going to touch a lot of people, and hopefully in a positive way that will change their life and make their life better. I like everybody to be able to walk down the road I walk down, where there are no bad days. You just have some that are not quite as good as the others.
Well, you're touching many lives today, and you'll touch many more with the recording of this. We'll go with a few more student questions, and then we'll let you go because we know it's getting kind of late for some of the kids. Pablo, you have a good question. Pablo is in Europe. Go ahead and ask your question.
Well, what thought helps you when you are going through a bad time?
What helped you? He wanted to know what helped, how did you get through a bad time? Like, what helps? What kind of advice could you give to these kids when they're going through bad times, given what you went through?
You have to recognize when you wake up in the morning, if you were pick up your breakfast plate and look underneath, there'd be a a setting of five playing cards. You know, the like you play cards. There's five cards under it, and that's your hand for the day. You'd like to think that you get a royal flush or maybe a full house or something in poker terms. But you may not get anything. You may get five cards that are totally unrelated to each other. And that's, I have a term, I call that a fiddly-wah-diddly. That means your cards are worthless. But those are the only cards you get today. And so you have to play those cards to the absolute best of your ability and get up tomorrow hoping you get a better hand. But there's no guarantee. And so it doesn't make any difference what your cards are. You have to learn to play those cards to the best, get the best results you can with what you have available to you that day. Hopefully you will learn something that day that will make tomorrow easier. And that's what drove us in prison. We had really, really, really crummy days when they beat you stuffing out of you. And you had to get up the next day and go back to work because we were on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for, in my case, 6.5 years. You didn't get a choice of what kind of day it was going to be. You had to make the best of that. You have to step up to the challenge. You know, I learned to do 300 push-ups nonstop while I was in prison because there was another guy there that could do more than that, and I was trying to best him as best I could. I learned to speak fluent Spanish in prison, tapping on a wall. I never heard it spoken, never heard it, saw it written. I learned by living next door to a guy who spoke fluent Spanish, who taught me how to do Spanish simply by tapping on my wall in a code that we used in prison. When I came home, I took the final exam in Spanish. The first college course I took was Spanish. I maxed the course the first night of class, never read the book. And so you have to accept you have these capacity to do these things. It's up to you to decide if you're going to use that for your, you know, to improve your life. If you're not willing to do that, then you're not going to get there.
Yeah, you are a true testament to the human potential. And guys, if you want to learn more, definitely check out edhubbardpow.com. We'll have the link in this video. One of our kids, they wanted to know, here, let me pull this one up. What was the concept you implemented that led to a 50% increase in productivity for a $350 million resource when it came
to... So it's a rather complicated story, but I'll make it very, very simple. We had 48 airplanes, F-40 airplanes, fighter airplanes, sitting on our ramp. And we were only producing 36 flights a day with 48 airplanes. Common sense told me there was a reason for that. And so I went to the maintenance guys and asked them why we couldn't produce more flights in a day. And it was because of the way we scheduled. And they said, give us another way to schedule. And I did. And so I changed all the rules, things that everybody had always thought you have to do it this way because that's the way we've always done it. Simply changed the rules. And the more we fly airplanes, the better they work. If you let them sit on the ground and do nothing all day, they start to leak and things break. And so by utilizing the airplanes more, we found out that we could create more flights a day. And not only that, the airplanes stayed in commission so we could add additional flights on those same airplanes. And so we went from flying 36 flights a day to flying 54 flights a day with exactly the same airplanes. It's a simple common sense approach. I don't claim to be a brilliant scientist or anything. I'm long on common sense. If there's something that we're doing and we're not doing it well enough, then it's time to change it. The old idea that this is the way we've always done it is the worst idea in the world, because if this is the way you've always done it, you ever heard you can't do the same thing every day and expect better results. You got to change. Change is the hardest thing for humans to do because they're comfortable in the way the environment is. You have to be uncomfortable in the way the environment is and start looking for ways to change it to make it better.
That's brilliant. So before we let you go, and I ask this of all of our guests, what kind of advice would you give to these kids as they're about to go off into the world onto the next chapters of their lives?
My advice is don't let somebody else determine what you can do. As we grow up, you know, the escape from the box, most people don't understand why I call that the, title of the book. When you're born, you're placed in a small container. It's an imaginary container, but it limits the amount of things that you can do in your life. And as you grow up, your parents and your teachers and everybody keep saying, well, you can't do that. Every time somebody tells me something I can't do, I write it down. I put the time when they told me that so that I can go back and tell them when I'm finished. Because every time you tell me I can't do something, that's challenged my mentality. It says, I can do anything if I really make the effort. And so I would say, never, never let anybody tell you what you can't do. Go and try it and see if you can do it. And if you do that on a regular basis, I guarantee you, you will trip and fall, and you will fall short occasionally, not every time. Every time you fall short, you got to get back up and try again. And if you do that, eventually you become very, very talented. You become very creative in solving problems other people think have no solution, and so on. Now, right now, if you have students in your audience right now in South Africa, find a way to invite me to speak in South Africa. I would love to go there. I've been to South Africa 9 times on photo safaris. I love South Africa. I can fly down there and speak to a school down there. Nothing. I don't charge to do things like that. If I'm going where I want to go, all it does cost you the price of one airplane ticket round trip for me to come and see you. I would love to go to South Africa again.
There you go. I know we have might have some students in Morocco, and possibly even Johannesburg. So guys, check out edhubbardpow.com. If you have more questions, go ahead and reach out. So Ed, before I end the meeting for all, I typically allow everyone to unmute and say thank you to our guests for joining us. And then I'm going to end the meeting for all. So can we all say thank you.
Ed
Hubbard. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.